I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour wrote a recent piece titled "A Little Paternalism in Medicine is a Good Thing." And our guest is also a doctor who writes, "It's hard to imagine a time when a physician could unilaterally decide what to do for a patient or to them without first considering the patient's views about their own medical care. Historically, many patients were even in the dark about their diagnosis." We'll be talking about those days, how that changed, and whether or not we should return to a time of perhaps a little paternalism. It may be a good thing in medicine. I'm sure we'll hear some of your very interesting stories this hour. Our guest is Dr. Nikhil Barot, an internist and an assistant professor at UCLA School of Medicine. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is @KDunnShow. Lines are open for you whenever you'd like to join us. Dr. Barot, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Kathleen.
Yeah, it should be a really interesting hour. Tell me about, you start the piece with a story about your grandfather in the 1980s. What is that story?
So I was young at the time, but my grandfather had a heart attack, and at that time, you know, physicians really had a different relationship with patients with regard to how they communicated medical decisions. So I kind of imagined myself being a fly on the wall at that time, and listening in on the conversation that was occurring between him and his cardiothoracic surgeon. This was before we would routinely take patients to the cardiac catheterization lab and place a stent, a much less invasive procedure. So what they would have offered him at the time would have been a cardiac bypass graft. So a really invasive procedure where, you know, they cut your chest open, your ribs up, and place new grafts on your heart. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of imagined myself back then listening in on this conversation, and I suspect that it was quite different than sort of the way we speak to patients these days. If I was to have a patient with a heart attack and offer a procedure, I would speak very differently in 2017 than his physicians would have in the early 1980s.
Mm-hmm. And knowing your grandfather, how do you think he would have liked to have been talked to? Would he have wanted to know about the procedure, about the extent of the heart attack, about the treatment for this, or would he have preferred to have been kept somewhat in the dark?
I think culturally, you know, with my background, I'm Indian, and I think a lot of Indians in America like to involve the family in the decision-making process. Mm-hmm. And so I think he would have maybe at that time deferred to, you know, his children at his bedside just to ensure that everyone was on the same page going forward. I think he was very enthusiastic about getting fixed, getting better.
Sure.
And I think that's universal. I think most people in his situation who are confronted with a catastrophic event like a heart attack want to feel better. It's a physical form of suffering, but there's also the sense that maybe this is, you know, without a procedure, he's not going to live long. He's not going to be able to see his children and his grandchildren. So I think that's kind of the background of the conversation. He probably wanted to know enough about the procedure to know that he would get better from it. And I think his physicians at that time would have been quite adept at convincing him that this was the right way, this was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. This is amazing. I just don't think about this and never thought about it, to tell you the truth. But a survey of Philadelphia area physicians, you write, from 1953, this is astounding. 70% either never told or usually did not tell their patients that they had been diagnosed with cancer. Really?
Yeah, that is really astounding that, you know, that we've come so far from that time. You know, this is the physician, you know, glorified in the old hospital dramas that, you know, really took a patriarchal view of their role in discussing therapeutic options, diagnostic options with patients. So it was the time of physician knows best. And culturally, I think people accepted that to some degree. Now, if we really think about the heart of the matter, though, what we're really talking about, the central phenomenon taking place during a medical encounter between a patient and a physician, is information exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I trace in the essay is really the history of what's gone on during this process of information exchange. How has medical decision-making changed over the years? And so in the 1950s, there was I talk about a pendulum of medical decision-making. This was a time when the pendulum was swung way towards one end of the arc, where it was physician-dominated, very paternalistic. And that was one of many studies that showed that very often physicians didn't engage their patients with the sort of communication that we expect now.
And before we move on to what happened in 1957, you talk about many physicians fearing that revealing the diagnosis was tantamount to a psychological death sentence. Is there some truth in that?
I think there is some there is a sense amongst physicians even today that if they tell their patients a bad diagnosis, they may have some sort of psychological suffering that's hard to understand or even measure. So I think that is true. I work at a public hospital in Los Angeles, and so we have a pretty culturally rich and diverse patient population from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, many of the patients that I have to inform about a bad diagnosis, the family gets in the way first. They say, grandmother doesn't want to know that she has cancer. Let us tell her that she just has abdominal pain, and the doctors are going to fix it. So we still have to respect that. And I think there is a sense amongst physicians even to this day that if we tell patients exactly what's going on, that we're going to harm them in some way. So a lot of studies have come out since then showing that that's a bit of a fallacy. That at least in the broader American culture, there's been a trend towards more information. Patients want to know more. They want to be engaged in the decision-making process in a meaningful way. And the 1950s was a sort of dark ages for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were finally coming out of the light.
Well, and now, perhaps unfortunately, in some instances, we can diagnose ourselves because you think something's wrong with you and you go right to the internet and you discover
that
you're going to die, and then you go to the doctor
right. And
the doctor says, oh, it's not as bad as you thought it was because you looked up all this info.
I mean, that's one whole, another whole level of information that physicians have to deal with. Now
I'll
the
bet.
Patients come with, printouts and links to websites and... they've already emailed, three other world experts about what's going on. So, as part of the information exchange that's occurring, I think in many ways it's very good to have patients who are informed about what's going on with their bodies. I always say that, patients are the ones that know their bodies the best. And so the more information they know, the better. But there are downsides to, some of those exchanges. I think it does entail some sort of psychological fears and suffering, what one physician called the affect heuristic, right? So when you hear about potential therapy, our emotions really take the driver's seat. And sometimes we make choices purely based on sort of the limbic, the emotional aspect of our understanding of our illness rather than the rational part of it.
Mm-hmm. And actually, you go on in your essay to say that physicians need to do both. I've certainly had doctors who have given information, in a couple seconds, here's what I have to say about this, and then walked out of the room, which leaves you in this, you've been jolted by information, and you're reacting to it emotionally, too. So a doctor really has to, and I wonder if you are trained to do this, not only give the information, but also think about the emotional response that the patient has.
I think it's one of the big holes in medical training is, how we communicate with patients. That's a whole nother hours long topic. But in a nutshell, we aren't trained very well. If we had started our medical school training with learning just how to communicate with one another as physicians and then learn how to communicate with patients, I think building on that, we would have become better doctors. And, mm-hmm. And I think there's a large movement to really, that's kind of the sort of next step in, you know, providing better patient-centered care.
Yes.
Is really improving how doctors communicate with their patients.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot to learn still. I mean, there's a lot of ways to go, but there is a movement in that direction.
1957, let's go back to history for a moment. There was a mm-hmm. case that prodded doctors to telling their patients what was going on. What was the case, and what were the ramifications?
Right. So this occurred at Stanford Hospital in 1957. A patient, Martin Salgo, underwent aortography. It's a procedure where they inject dye into the large blood vessel. And I think they were looking for whether or not he, you know, had some stenosis or clot forming in his legs. They did not inform him of the risks of the procedure. And what eventually happened was that as a complication of the procedure, he became paralyzed from the waist down. So he sued, and it basically formed the courts really sided with him. It formed sort of the legal and ethical basis of informed consent. The courts stated that since his physicians did not inform him of all of the risks of the procedure, that they were then liable.
Dr. Brode, you talk about, let's talk about your own practice for a moment, that you have found on occasion that you've been looking at the decision, making the pendulum go back toward the paternalistic end a little bit, and you talk about an 84-year-old woman with lung cancer, and I'm wondering how you handled that case.
Yeah, so that sort of... It was a tricky case. You know, I had an elderly lady who basically was incidentally found to have a mass in her lungs, and we engaged in this new model of decision making, which we call shared decision making, which is more of a collaborative process between patients and physicians, in which we take into account the patient's values, goals, and preferences in making the medical decision. So whereas paternalism was one end of the arc and informed consent, as deemed by the Salgo-Stanford decision, was the other end of the arc, shared decision-making kind of brought us back into an equilibrium between the two. But what I argue in the article is that even this collaborative process, even though we're taking into account the patient's understanding of the illness and what their goals and preferences are, it sometimes falls short. And how it falls short is that physicians still are in some ways abdicating their roles as guides or experts. And we're not really guiding the patients to what we think is the best option for them. So in the case of my elderly patient with the lung mass, you know, she was quite nervous to find out what this was, and rightly so. You know, at that age, when you do a biopsy of the lungs, the complications can be fatal.
Okay.
And she had very, very reasonable concerns about the procedure. What I noticed was that what I did in the situation was I reframed her choices for her. You know, I think in the past, what I may have done in this shared decision making model was kind of very textbook, go through what other physicians would have done in the community or what the literature would have supported, which would have been a biopsy in this case. But just understanding who she was and understanding my role there as an expert, I nudged her in the direction of actually not pursuing a biopsy because I think for her the emotional weight of the biopsy was too burdensome, and the benefit was not really apparent to either of us at that time.
And you could tell that you relieved her worries because you saw her clutching her purse, which
right,
would do when
yeah,
we get
so
nervous and tense, and then she became more relaxed and let the hand go.
I mean, it goes back to what you're speaking about earlier, Kathleen, that, you know, physicians really need to know how to take the pulse of patients, and it's a dynamic process. We need to read the unspoken language that they're communicating to us, and it could be something as simple as, you know, clutching a purse. Very often, patients don't want to tell physicians what they're feeling, and physicians don't want to ask because, you know, they don't have the time or they don't have the expertise on how to communicate, or the experience is emotionally burdening for the physician.
Right.
And so very often we leave a lot of things unsaid. Mm-hmm. So I think this was an opportunity for me to read her language in a nonverbal way and understand that this was really a burdensome choice for her. So what I engaged was this idea of libertarian paternalism. And it's interesting where this idea comes from. It's actually Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler, two behavioral economists, came up with the idea in 2003, and they wrote about it in an economics journal. Basically, the idea is that when we're confronted with choices, the people who are providing the choices have the option of framing the architecture of the choice in a way that can lead to the best possible outcome. So going back to the Salgo versus Stanford decision in 1957, which kind of established informed consent as a legal and ethical model, the judges in that decision actually noted that with the decision, patients weren't necessarily going to make the best choices, that in allowing them to be autonomous and self-determined, that they could still make the least helpful choices for them. But we as physicians, in order to kind of ensure that the patients are still getting the best options delivered to them, what we can do is kind of manage the architecture of the choice. And so one example of this is just walking into a cafeteria, right? If you were to walk into a cafeteria and you see, you know, the donuts and the potato chips, that's the first thing you see, and the salad bar is way out in the corner and you don't even see it before you get to the cash register, you're more likely to choose the unhealthful option.
Mm-hmm.
But if that salad bar is front and center, as soon as you enter the cafeteria, you're more likely to choose that. And so we haven't removed the idea of choice. This is the libertarian aspect of it. But there is some paternalism there. There is some right. nudging in the direction of the best choice. Another example would be organ transplantation. You know, in other countries outside of the U.S., there is the idea of presumed consent that when you die, you're automatically enrolled to give your organs to someone else that may need them. You still have the option to opt out of that. But what happens on a societal level is that more people get organ transplants. Now, we haven't removed the choice to not give your organs. We've just changed the architecture of that choice.
Hmm. Well, let's welcome phone calls. I'm sure we'll have a lot of people who have stories they want to tell. Dr. Nikhil Barot is our guest. He wrote a piece that caught our attention, A Little Paternalism in Medicine is a Good Thing. He's an internist and an assistant professor at UCLA School of Medicine. When you have to get, and we all from time to time get news that we don't like very much from our doctor, what is the best course of action for the medical profession? Should there be, as he described, a kind of libertarian paternalism involved here? Our doctor is attuned to the emotions that you have when you're receiving a diagnosis. Do you want them to give you a whole bunch of information about all the alternatives available? Do you want them to guide you to a best place? Do you go to the doctor with hours and hours of research that you've done yourself on the internet and you kind of diagnose yourself? And do you like that? Or do you think that maybe we too much of that? Our phone lines are open. We'd love to hear from you. Do you think we need a little more paternalism in medicine? Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. The article is on our Facebook page if you'd like to read it. And Twitter is at K Dunn Show. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, two phone calls. Dave in Madison is first. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Great topic. I am wondering, a lot of this approach seems to require a good amount of face time and ability to listen to patients. And I wonder if in the world of the electronic medical record and the way that doctors interact with those devices in the exam room, whether that's possible. I mean, I've gone into the doctor, and while I'm telling them what's wrong, I'm talking to the back of their head because they're clicking on their screens. And especially if they want to go kind of off script and do something that's not necessarily in the guidelines, they've got to spend all their time clicking through screens to get to it. How can we engage in this kind of perceptive medicine with that kind of an arrangement?
I think you have a very valid point there. I think a lot of doctors are kind of caught up in these EMRs, these electronic medical records, as you talk about. And there's, you know, been studies showing that the face time with patients is reduced, and that the efficiency is actually decreased with some of these EMRs. So it's a challenge. I mean, I think, you know, one of the ways to ensure that we're communicating better is not relying on the note-taking and the time with the screen, and sort of moving our attention back to the patient in front of us, the human being in front of us. So it's a challenge. I mean, I don't have an easy answer for that, but, you know, I think just understanding that these technologies aren't necessarily always in the patient's best interest. They're great for medical billing and for insurance companies and for legal documentation, but they sometimes leave the patient, you know, out in the cold.
Mm-hmm. Anything more, Dave?
Well, I had one good experience recently that gives a suggestion. I went to a sports medicine appointment, and they had a professional scribe, I think they called it, that sat in the room with the doctor, and he did all of the entry into the computer, and I got a chance to really have a face-to-face conversation with my doc. Any thoughts on the use of scribes?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely those models, as well as probably we're moving in the direction of kind of voice recognition software, where, you know, that no typing has to occur at all. But
Those
are definitely great options for improving FaceTime with patients. Hmm.
Thanks, Dave, for your interesting call. Kevin in Madison. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. I just wanted to make a comment. My wife was going through breast cancer, and she still is currently. We went through UW-Madison University Breast Cancer Center, and we had nothing but a great experience, even with going through breast cancer. They laid out all of our options. Every time we went to an appointment, we had a lot of face time. They asked us any questions we had about any of the options we had, and she ended up going with a double mastectomy because it was laid out so well for us that it was, just might have been the biggest option or the best option, although it was kind of a big change for us. I just wanted to comment that there are people out there having good experiences with their doctors.
Oh, I'm sure that's true. And Kevin, do you feel that you were guided by the medical community to a certain recommendation that you could feel comfortable with, or was all the information put in your hands and then you went through all of it and decided?
Absolutely. I would absolutely agree with that. They gave us all the options, all the good things, the bad things about each option, and the consequences, and you know what the follow-up would be with each option.
Uh-huh.
And it was great because they were following one side of the breast for the cancer, and then after she got a double mastectomy, they tested the other side, and the other side ended up being a bigger problem than the original side we went in for.
Oh, my.
So I feel like the doctors at the UW Hospital really, really saved us a lot of hassle and might have saved my wife's life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, it makes me think of this book by Barry Schwartz from 2004, The Paradox of Choice, in which he kind of details how at least in our culture, when we're confronted with a lot of different choices, we sometimes become numb, or we become overburdened by the different options. And I think what physicians now need to understand is that patients are coming with a lot of information, and there are so many more choices out there when it comes to medical decision making. It sounds like, you know, your physicians, your wife's physicians, may have done things a little bit outside of the book that they felt was best for her, and they guided you in that direction. So I'm really heartened to hear that, and thanks for the call.
Yeah. And for being such a support to your wife, wasn't it nice the way he took this, he and his wife were taking this on together?
Oh, absolutely.
That's solid.
Yeah.
That's solid. I just had a question before we take more phone calls. When you know that you have to deliver news that is disturbing, very disturbing news to a patient, how do you learn how to do that, doctor?
So, yeah, I'm actually trained in pulmonary and critical care as well as palliative care. So I do have, you know, some formal training in how to communicate bad news to patients. And I work at a teaching hospital, so it's something that I try to convey to my residents and medical students as well. It's challenging. I think what's key in these situations is something that doctors aren't good at, and that's listening. Trying to really allow for the patient to kind of understand what you've told them, give them the space to hear the bad news, and then maybe come back at another time to explain the therapy. So that's one of the tools that we use, is this idea of therapeutic listening.
Mm-hmm.
There's a saying in palliative care where we say, the traditional saying is, don't just stand there, do something. In palliative care, we say, don't just do something, stand there. So it's the idea of really taking a seat, you know, closing your mouth, and kind of listening to the patient. And that's part of that engagement is reading the nonverbal clues about what's going on emotionally. Because very often, you know, when you hear bad news, you're not ready to discuss with the oncologist you just met what you're feeling and what your fears are. Mm-hmm. So it may take several different patient encounters over the course of days or weeks or months to really get at the heart of the issue.
800-486-8655. Teresa in Madison, hello.
Hello. Thank you for your comments. I do agree with you about the palliative care and what you're saying about that. Regarding paternalism in medicine, I think the model of medicine has changed completely, and I think that there's very little room for it in medicine. I think our patients are much more well-informed about medicine, and I think providing all of the options for them and guiding them through the processes is critical.
Absolutely. I think what occurs, at least from the physician standpoint, is we recognize that there's two fallacies. One is that people always make the best choices, and two is that paternalism always involves coercion. So what I address in the essay is both of these fallacies. And I think a lot of physicians are kind of loath to admit that paternalism has never gone away. It still exists, and it's utilized frequently for decisions big and small. You know, when you come to the emergency room and you have stomach pain, they start putting an IV in you. They don't necessarily go over the risk, benefits, and alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
There's a presumed consent in a lot of these instances. But I think there is still room for this idea of libertarian paternalism where, we as physicians kind of alter the choices in a way that favors still what we think is best for the patient.
Well, and it's true because you've all gone to school and for many years you've gone to school to figure out what's best for the patient. So that's kind of your job as well. As well as being in tune with the patient, you also, you know the story, you know what's up.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, what I'd like to see is that physicians kind of reappropriate their roles as guides and experts. I think over the course of this history of medical decision-making, that pendulum has, you know, swung back and forth quite a bit. But for an individual patient or a family, really trying to understand what is best for them based on their values, and using a model of decision making that maybe involves, you know, a little bit more paternalism or a little bit less of one of these other things.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do? You mentioned your family being from India, mm-hmm. and families wanted to be involved in decision making. How do doctors and hospitals deal with, it's a very diverse country, all the cultural differences there may be and all the language differences there are?
Absolutely. I mean, in a melting pot like Los Angeles, it is quite challenging. But I think that's one of the things that the sort of experience engenders is just understanding what to expect with different cultures. I think going into it blind with a culture that you've never encountered is always challenging. But if you have a sense for, you know, certain cultures not wanting to know as much or not wanting to tell a family member at all the diagnosis or deciding to, you know, regardless of the outcome, to go full bore with fully aggressive life preserving care, it's challenging. But there's no textbook for these things. This is kind of the art of medicine.
Right. Thanks, Therese, very much for your call. And let's go next to Debbie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call and thank you for this topic. I just wanted to share a couple of experiences. I think the common thing under the decisions that doctors make that are helpful is that there's a deep level of respect. And so I also battle with breast cancer, and I remember really being moved by this radiologist. I came in for a biopsy, and my husband and I were talking about how I'd done something alternative and gotten rid of some cancer in the past. And he said, without yet having done the biopsy, he said, well, you're not going to want to do that with this tumor because it looks like it's stage 3, and you have to do a couple rounds of chemo just to kick it out.
Ooh.
This was a shock to us.
Yeah.
And then he called back the next day and said, oh, I'm sorry. Actually, I think it's a benign tumor. I'm so sorry.
Oh, my gosh.
But I was so grateful to him for trusting us enough to sort of think out loud and give us that information early. For some reason, that really was helpful to me because it often happens when you're in test and you're getting these ultrasounds and things and you're just thinking, I know they know what they're seeing and they're not going to tell me. You want to know right away, so that was helpful. Then the second part of it, it turned out that the tumor, the Fallopian tumor, was so large that actually it was, it wasn't completely benign. It was like borderline. And the surgeon said at first I wouldn't need chemo or radiation. And then the story changed, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to get the radiation. And she said that they recommended it. And I said, well, I don't really feel like there's a lot of data out there. And she said, oh, come with me. And she took me. I didn't realize that hospitals have research libraries. She took me down the basement to the research library and told the librarian to look for all the data, all the studies within a given time period in English with human subjects and email them both to her and to myself.
Oh, my.
And so that I could have the data to really make my own decision, you know, which I did. And she said, if you decide against radiation, I completely support you. It's not my recommendation, but I completely support you. And so I was really moved by that, too, that she had the respect to actually just hand me the research.
Mm. So what did you do?
I went without the radiation, and I did a bunch of other things, but there was research that said could also lower the probability of it returning, you know, things like exercise. And so that's what I did, and I'm, you know, 3 years out and still fine.
Good.
So we'll see.
Good. Dr. Broat.
Yes.
What do you say?
So, yeah, I mean, it's really great to hear that that physicians are encouraging patients to expand the information about their disease. I think it kind of rebalances the sort of informational asymmetry. The challenge is then, you know, once you have all that information, are you going to be overwhelmed by it?
Mm-hmm.
Because when a lot of patients come with this information, they may not understand the nuances of the decisions. And to be honest, a lot of the literature, a lot of the cases that come out may support population-wide decisions, but it may not make sense for a given patient to pursue a particular therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think kind of understanding the risks, the benefits, the alternatives of therapies, and then coming to physicians with that information I think it makes for a more meaningful patient encounter.
Thank you so much, Debbie, for your call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our guest this hour is Dr. Nikhil Barot, an internist and an assistant professor at the UCLA School of Medicine. It's also a teaching hospital, so he has young people he's working with who are entering the medical profession. We're talking about libertarian paternalism may be a good thing in medical care, and how doctors used to not tell patients what was wrong with them. You could have cancer and you weren't told you had cancer. And this was just fairly recently in the 1950s, and all of that changed and maybe went too much of the direction of, here are the facts, ma'am or sir, without an emotional response to how the facts may affect a person who is receiving the news. And so we're talking about this little bit of paternalism being a good thing in the mix. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we certainly welcome your phone calls. I know this is it's the subject of our show tomorrow, Dr. Brett, I'm sure you have some thoughts on this as we talk about libertarian paternalism. I'm wondering how doctors, how people in your profession are feeling about our healthcare system being in limbo at this point in time. Are you a little bit worried about where we are and how much we know about where we are, and having sort of information at our fingertips so that we can tell our legislators what we want when it comes to healthcare?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really unfortunate what's going on in terms of the most recent rounds of healthcare legislation. And, you know, I work at a safety net hospital. And so in many ways, we feel like the rug is being pulled from under us. You know, we serve patients that are kind of the blood vessels of this city, and to kind of take away the sort of the sort of access to healthcare that they've achieved with the ACA it's really been disheartening to see. I think there's a lot of ways to improve healthcare, absolutely, but I think our legislatures need to understand that as physicians, at the end of the day, we want what's best for our patients. We want good access to care. We want efficient, affordable care. We want to be able to know that our legislatures are thinking about our patients when they're drafting these ideas.
Yeah. Well said. Let's go to Elizabeth next in Madison. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
How are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good.
I'm an obstetrical nurse, and I was wondering the doctor's thoughts on answering the question, what would you do if it were your wife? What would you do if it were your daughter? I'm always very hesitant to answer that from an ethical standpoint. And it's hard to...
I see what you're saying. I mean, I think... you know, when these decisions become personal for people in the medical field, it can sometimes seem like you're not necessarily speaking what you advocate for other people. But I think in my own experience, what I've always done with my family members is kind of try to understand what is important to them. At a fundamental level, before pursuing a particular therapeutic option, you know, with some of the callers have mentioned breast cancer. I had a family member with breast cancer, and you know, she actually did not want to lose her hair. We talked about the risks and benefits of chemo, and decided against it because it was more valuable for her to remain private about her cancer and not have to have the public display of losing her hair. And so we kind of went against the recommendations of her physicians. And it is challenging, you know, coming from, you know, a healthcare background and trying to enact these ideas for family members, you still want to do what's best for them. And so I have my physician hat on and I have my relative hat on. Mm-hmm. I'm a family member, you know.
Thank you, Elizabeth, so much for your call. And let's go to Gundega. Is that, am I pronouncing that correctly, in Madison?
Right, Gundega.
Gundega, hi.
About 45 years ago, I was a grad student and I walked a lot, you know, 10 miles a day or more, just instead of taking the bus. And I developed real bad knee pain. You know, it turned out to be runner's knee, but I didn't know that for 5 years because the doctor I went to, who was a GP in a very respectable university setting, said that my knees hurt because I was in grad school and that if I dropped out of grad school and concentrated on being a wife and mother, they'd
stop hurting.
Oh, my gosh.
You're kidding. Oh, wow.
So I didn't dare bring my knee pain to anyone again for 5 years. And by that time, I'd taken up running and got referred to sports medicine and got the right exercises and everything fixed up immediately. And, you know, as crazy as that was, it just isn't going to happen again now. And then this year, I went through breast cancer experience and from diagnostic mammogram, you know, screening, diagnostic, biopsy, surgery, radiation, follow-up, every step of the way, I had my choices. I made most of the choices the way people suggested. I happen to be a science editor, so I had a lot of information anyway. But again, the respect and the kindness that I encountered was really wonderful. That's all I had to say.
Thank you so much. What a contrast, 70s and now, Doctor.
Absolutely. I mean, again, going back to, you know, sort of the dark ages of paternalistic medicine, I think what I'd like to convey to, you know, other members of the healthcare community is that, first and foremost, we have to be excellent listeners and communicators. So if we're not listening to our patients, if we're dismissing their concerns, then we're not being good physicians.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Bob next in northern Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello. My question is, many of us, if not most of us, don't live anywhere near teaching hospitals. And I'm just wondering if that sort of setting has a bearing on whether you run into a paternalistic or a libertarian approach to medicine or openness or whatever. Hmm. And I'm just curious about that.
You know, I'm not sure if I have the right answer to that or if there is a right answer to that, whether or not there's a sort of rural city divide in these sorts of experiences of paternalism. But certainly I think there's challenges to rural doctors you know, we city doctors don't necessarily face. But I think one of the advantages of having a doctor that you see regularly in a community setting, you know, over the course of 30, 40, 50 years is that they really get to know you in a fundamental way as a human being. They really understand what's important and valuable to you over the years. So I think there is an advantage, actually, in those types of settings because there's a familiarity there. That we may not necessarily experience in academic centers in the city. You know, a lot of our patients may be referred, and so we don't have that history of lifelong engagement with patients to really understand where they're coming from.
Hmm. How do you decide what doctor you're going to?
well, you know, I'm one of these doctors who doesn't go to a doctor a lot and looks up things on the internet to solve my own medical problems. I think the usual avenues, you know, with insurance these days, you're kind of limited who you can see. Mm-hmm. And so you're given a list of potential options. And, you know, you go on these physician websites to see who's rated the best or who has the best reviews.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting being on the other side. I mean, I'm recently, you know, been taking care of a family member for the last few months and had to see medicine from the other side. He was in an intensive care unit, and you know, just seeing how the pitfalls of communication in those settings from the patient standpoint was really revealing to me.
Mm. Let's go to Mary in Amherst. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling with, I am a nurse right now. I'm a public health nurse, and I used to be a hospice nurse. And I really agree with the doctor's assessment in terms of really engaging with the patient, really talking to them about what options are and what this sort of means to them. But I sort of take issue. I think we need to look to a language expert to reframe the idea of paternalism, because I think paternalism goes back to the old model where women were kept out of the medical profession, all were men, and now at least half of the medical students are women. So if you're going to be looking to a new model, you should call it maybe libertarianism, you know, something
absolutely.
Else that
is different. It's a bit of an outdated term for these days, you know, but I think in the medical community, paternalism has also almost become like a four-letter word where we don't want to admit that there are times when it's okay to engage in this sort of practice where, you know, we're being retaking our role as experts and guides for our patients.
Mary, thanks so much for your call, and we go to Susan in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. If you think the 70s were bad, I was a student nurse 1958 to 1961.
Oh, great.
And we were told it was unethical to tell the patients anything, including such minor things now as, what's my blood pressure? The answer was, your doctor will let you know if he wants
to. Whoa, my.
And what are these medicines for? The doctor will let you know if he wants you to know.
If he wants you to know.
Yes.
Oh.
And it was just what happened then.
And what did you think about it at the time? Did you think, Susan, this isn't right?
No, actually, the doctor was God.
Ah.
And we were told that it was unethical to assert the doctor's authority.
Mm-hmm.
I think
since that time, along with sort of the evolution of medical decision-making, coincident with that was sort of the rise of our understanding of biomedical ethics. And so this idea of autonomy, patient autonomy, really didn't exist in the time you're referring to. And so that's really become much more paramount when we think about, you know, patients' ability to make choices of their own volition and self-determination. So it's a very different time.
I'm wondering if doctors didn't tell their patients they had cancer back in the early 50s and the patients kept getting sicker and sicker, what happened? Would they just die of the disease and never know what the cause of death was?
Yeah, you know, I think it was also a time when, you know, the word cancer had a different meaning. You know, cancer back then was a death sentence in many ways, and it's not now. I mean, I think the women we've heard from earlier in the conversation, they're both breast cancer survivors. So cancer, and for many, many people in this country, has become either a disease that they've conquered in some ways, or a disease that has become chronic and which they may not necessarily die of.
Mm.
So the diseases, in fact, have changed, or because of our the treatments available nowadays.
Thank you, Dr. Barod. I'll bet you're a great doctor, too. I like your manner. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Dr. Nikhil Barot, he's an internist, assistant professor at UCLA's School of Medicine. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production. Tomorrow, we are talking about what's going on with the health care bill. That's at 2 o'clock, at 1 o'clock. The strategy for immigration activists has changed and evolved. We'll talk about that at 1 o'clock, so please join us mañana.